You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to our first podcast of this two-part series on individualizing treatment approaches in spondyloarthropathy conditions, best practices for selection, intensification, and shared decision-making. This is hosted by Med Learning Group, and this discussion is designed to meet the educational needs of advanced practice professionals, including physician assistants and nurse practitioners who care for patients with psoriatic arthritis and radiographic or non-radiographic axial spondyloarthritis. I'm Robert Lowerty. I'm a physician assistant and director of rheumatology at Prisma Health Medical Mall in Alcoa, Tennessee. And today I'm speaking with Wendy Simmons, who is a physician assistant in Wilmington, North Carolina at Carolina Arthritis Associates, where she brings her expertise in managing a wide range of rheumatologic conditions for her patients. Wendy, welcome.
Thanks, Robert, so much. I'm excited to be here and have participating in educational learning with conversations with you today.
It's good to have you. So our conversation today, Wendy, is going to be centered around treatment selection and sequencing for spondyloarthropathy conditions, including treatment algorithms and treat-to-target recommendations. Now, Wendy, I know that you see a lot of patients with ankylosing spondylitis because our practices are rather similar, and so do I. The first-line treatment remains NSAIDs, according to the ASAS and EULAR guideline recommendations. But at what point do you consider switching a patient to second-line treatments?
Absolutely. I do see a lot of ankylosing spondylitis patients, as you do, for sure. And as far as the first-line treatment, we know that NSAIDs do remain the first-line treatment according to the ASAS and EULAR, as well as the ACR, SSA, and Spartan guidelines. It's also important that we document that use of NSAIDs in that patient, as we know in the chart, so that down the road when we are considering biologics, that will help the patient with access. However, if a patient has a high ankylosing spondylitis disease activity score, which we'll refer to as ASDAS, or an elevated CRP indicating inflammation, after that adequate trial of two different NSAIDs, at that point, I'm going to move quickly to biologics. We know these patients have waited a while. We want to halt that disease activity quickly. So I will move quickly then at that point to biologics. The algorithms also are emphasizing choosing between TNF inhibitors and IL-17 inhibitors based on comorbidities of the patient. For example, if our patient has a concomitant inflammatory bowel disease, I'll lean towards TNF monoclonal antibodies like infliximab, etanercept, or adalimumab. However, if they have significant psoriasis, an IL-17 inhibitor like ixekizumab or secukizumab would be my go-to. The guidelines are set out in the charts, the ASAS EULAR guidelines, and I just recommend that if listeners have the opportunity to be able to print those out and have them to their access to be able to follow those guidelines and learn them.
The 2019 ACR-SAA Spartan guidelines seem to prioritize TNF inhibitors over newer options like the IL-17 drugs and the Janus kinase or JAK inhibitors, unless, of course, there are specific contraindications or primary non-response, or as you mentioned, Wendy, overriding considerations with their comorbidities.
Absolutely, Robert. That does make sense. One does have to keep in mind that if there is a primary non-response to that first TNF inhibitor, that's saying it never worked. At that point, I will switch my patient to an IL-17 inhibitor rather than trying a second TNF inhibitor. However, if it did work initially and then lost some efficacy, or this is considered a secondary failure, I might switch to a different TNF inhibitor. I do explain that to my patients. I feel that the goal is to control that disease, and it's like driving out down a highway and you are in the TNF lane. If that's not working to get to the destination, then we need to change lanes and let's jump over to that IL-17 lane.
That is a very interesting analogy. I don't know that I've ever heard it explained like that. I like that a lot. Interestingly, the ACR and SAA Spartan guidelines conditionally recommend against a very strict treat-to-target strategy in favor of leaving it up to more clinician judgment. They cited a lack of robust evidence that tight control actually leads to better long-term outcomes in axial SpA, as well as the risk of cycling through these treatments too quickly. And as we all know in the past, when there wasn't a plethora of these drugs, as there are now, we would cycle through them and you didn't have anything left to use. However, international groups like ASAS and EULAR advocate for a treat-to-target approach, so it's still out there. And they were aiming for clinical remission, which in that case would be an ASDAS score of less than 1.3, or low disease activity, which would be an ASDAS score of less than 2.1. Again, I think that insurance, I think, sometimes plays a part in this, but I have found it easier over the last few years to initiate treatment with IL-17 drugs over an anti-TNF in the current environment.
Those are great points, Robert. And to your mention of the treat-to-target strategy in favor of physician judgment, that really plays a large part as well. With our physician assistants, nurse practitioners, we're in that room with the patient and, you know, we're following that patient. So judgment is an important part, certainly. And also, as you mentioned, the risk of cycling through treatments too quickly can be of poor favor for some of the patients as well. So we want to certainly follow our guidelines as they are. And advocate for treat-to-target approaches to get some type of a clinical remission or low disease activity. But let me move into talking about some tools with regards approaching that tight control, which can be a challenge, as we know, as we're tracking our patients' progress. I've been relying heavily on PROMs, and to explain that a little bit more for others. These are patient-reported outcome measurement information systems. And they're measurement looking at aspects of our patients with regards to depression, their physical function, showing strong correlations with other traditional measures. So I do take that certainly heavily into account when I'm evaluating the patient. Also, I like to use the BASDAI for ankylosing spondylitis symptoms. And for our listeners, that's the Bath Ankylosing Spondylitis Disease Activity Index. This is looking at several questions that we can cover with our patients with regards to their fatigue, you know, their spine pain, their morning stiffness, and also the quality of how long that stiffness is or how severe the pain is, but also the tenderness with those patients. And then also finally, the BASDAI for function, which is also another measure to help us determine those quality of life measures for our patients. But the treat-to-target strategy really pushes for the ASDAS as it incorporates the CRP levels, making it more objective if we are following those patients with CRPs.
Agreed. There are a lot of tools out there that we can definitely use. And interestingly enough, having just switched to a new electronic health management program, a lot of these EMRs out there have facility to input this data, and the EMR actually generate a score for our patients, which can make it a little bit easier to track these things, especially like the ASDAS when there are labs involved. It can automatically add that in there and save us a lot of calculation time when we follow our patients. But I'm also trying to apply a very similar treat-to-target approach for psoriatic arthritis. And in that case, I tend to use the GRAPPA recommendations a little bit more often. My target is obviously minimal disease activity, or what we refer to in our business as MDA. But equally important is considering patient preferences in their treatment and what they're willing to take. The most effective medication is, of course, the one that the patient will actually use, ensuring that they get their therapy appropriately.
Agreed. Absolutely. I agree with that. And And honestly, I love the GRAPPA updated treatment recommendations for psoriatic arthritis that came out in 2021. Another chart that I highly recommend our listeners track down and keep in their office as well, which does help. You know, this, as we know, takes into consideration, as you mentioned, the patient, those shared treatment decisions, which we're going to be talking about. As you said, to your point, Robert, if we don't talk with the patient, have these shared decision making, they're not going to take the therapy. And many of our patients have comorbidities. So a lot of things to take into consideration with our patients. Let's take a look a little bit into a deeper dive with the MDA criteria, because this does enter into the importance of those shared decision making, developing that treatment strategy for our patients. We want to meet some type of minimal disease activity criteria for psoriatic arthritis. And for our patients to be able to meet that, there's 7 criteria that really need to meet 5 of those. Out of the 7 tender joint counts, we need to find 1 or less of those. Swollen joint counts, 1 or less of those. We need to look at the skin psoriasis activity with the psoriasis area and severity index also being 1 or less, or the body surface area being 3% or less. Another is the patient's pain. Their visual analog scale needs to be 1.5 centimeters or less. Also, the patient's global disease activity, how they see themselves doing, that score should be 20 millimeters or less. And then disability, you know, what is their health assessment questionnaire information with their disability index going to show us? And that score needs to be equal to or less than 0.5. And then finally, an important one, enthesitis. And one of the enthesial sites that I tend to go to is that Achilles tendon. I think that one, when there is activity, certainly will raise a score. And for that to meet the minimal disease criteria, needs to be 1 or less. So we see that, you know, in some of our patients, this might be easier than others. But this is the criteria that we need to be thinking about for meeting 5 out of 7 of the targets.
And unlike some of the measures that we've used, say, in rheumatoid arthritis in the past, this particular minimal disease activity measure is something that's actually very easy to do with the patient in the exam room during their visit. And with all of these different dimensions, it really stresses that psoriatic arthritis is something that covers a lot of different body systems and a lot of different dimensions of the disease. And this is why I think the GRAPPA guidelines are interesting and very helpful in that they seem to separate these different elements, as in joints and skin and enthesial points and dactylitis, et cetera, and make recommendations on which one of those dimensions or what combination of dimensions that this particular patient may have in guiding their treatment. But let's say, for instance, that your patient maybe is not hitting the target that we would like them to hit, Wendy. How do you intensify or consider switching medications in that situation? Maybe adding a conventional DMARD or switching biologics. How do you approach that problem?
Those are great questions, unique to different patients, for sure. Definitely by month 6, if I'm not seeing improvement in that patient, I will intensify. Certainly, I do consider in certain patients adding methotrexate, perhaps if there's some peripheral involvement, that is, you know, off-label, of course. And perhaps also maybe a little bit of a dated approach, but in some patients, certainly appropriate. But for predominantly axial disease and the patient's failed a TNF inhibitor, I'll switch to an IL-17 inhibitor like ixekizumab or secukizumab. Alternately, I will consider a JAK inhibitor like tofacitinib or upadacitinib rather than cycling to a second TNF inhibitor. And this is really going back to how I, you know, relate doing this to the patient, because of course, you know, we're talking to the patient and having this conversation in that exam room. So, you know, they don't always understand, you know, what's that TNF inhibitor and the IL-17s. And that's really where I go back to my highway analogy of my biologics to talk about changing lanes. Ultimately, the goal is to prevent that structural damage by keeping their inflammation suppressed. But yes, I do move quickly. I do like to change classes. And that go-to of IL-17 is most definitely appropriate.
And I think you're like me in that we do place a lot of emphasis on patient input in medication choice. And one of the reasons that I tend to steer towards the IL-17 drugs, even as initial therapy, is that these patients see these advertisements on television and they have looked at TNF inhibitors before and they see certain black box warnings that really bother them. And so when you're looking at the different guidelines and when some give you a little bit of leeway here and there, I'm kind of known as an interleukin 17 choice maker in that respect. But I tend to monitor at about the same rates as you do. I certainly would like to see them back in 2 to 3 months after we initiate therapy. And after that, if they're starting to respond, I think I will tend to stretch that out between 4 and 6 months. But it's all about getting to that point where you're meeting those targets and you're meeting those patient expectations of doing better. I think it's like the old song, you know, the patients will sing to you, "What have you done for me lately?"
It is. And again, you mentioned that you and I are similar in practice. And I am monitoring at 3 months, stretching out to 6 when they tend to be doing well. We certainly have those patients that I think before us thinking about, would I consider tapering therapy? The patient often, I feel, is, you know, in our office in front of us saying, you know, "Oh, I'm so great. You know, I'm coming in here at 6 months. We're talking about my next trip or my family. And, you know, there's not much to talk about at the office visit." Once that target is reached, would you consider tapering, Robert?
It's a very good question. And I am faced with that more often than you might think. These are very effective drugs, and patients a lot of times within 6 to 9 months are doing very well and have very minimal pain complaints and very minimal inflammatory complaints. But I do tell them that clinical trial data is very specific to the dose that was used and the outcomes that were seen. So I think in a lot of cases, tapering is not something that I tend to lean towards, especially if we want to sustain that remission that they have. And I think a common refrain with the patient is, "Well, how did you get here?" And you got here by taking the medication as recommended. And do we really want to mess with that? Is that the kind of risk that you might want to take? And I get open answers, but for the most part, I think they tend to want to continue treatment as prescribed.
And I agree with that. And if I may interject as well, and when I think about it, is I tend to also have that conversation with the patient in the room, you know, similar to you as well, that, you know, if you stop therapy now, it's like throwing a deck of cards up in the air with the immune system and really not knowing how they're going to, you know, readjust. And a high probability you will be back in the office with potentially worsening disease, which can lead to destruction. And then not knowing whether or not we'll be able to go back onto that same medication and you'll regain any type of efficacy. So those are definitely conversations, as you said and mentioned, that you have more often than not in those exam rooms with the patients and the direction that they're going. It's nice to have those conversations from the aspect that we've done a great job, right? We've made that change. We've got them on that IL-17. They're doing great. To my point earlier, they're meeting that minimal disease activity. And that is what we're there for. And I feel that, you know, that's our satisfaction and our happiness, seeing our patients at that point. Definitely not wanting them to stop and flare.
Absolutely. I was born and raised in the South, and there's an old saying, "If it's not broke, don't fix it." Well, Wendy, that's all the time we have for today's discussion. We'll continue the discussion in our second podcast titled A Primer on Personalized Care for Patients with Spa Conditions, where we're going to discuss patient quality of life, treatment adherence barriers, and shared decision-making practices for eliciting patient preferences and assessing disease severity. So be sure to tune in. It's been great talking to you, Wendy, and thank you for taking the time to speak with us today.
My pleasure as well, Robert.
And thanks to all of our listeners for joining us. This discussion was brought to you by the MedLearning Group, who, in support of improving patient care, is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, or the ACCME, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, or the ACPE, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center, or ANCC, to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. The CMA activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would also like to give a special thank you to our grant supporter, Lily, who provided an educational grant for this activity. Please have a great day.